Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're going to be talking about the attack on fake news and how it's really an attack on alternative media. We'll be joined by investigative journalist Dave Lindorf. And later in the program, we'll turn our attention to one of the antidotes for so-called fake news. We'll be joined by Professor Nolan Higdon, and we'll be talking in depth about critical media literacy education. Please stay with us. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the Thaw brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We won. We got that love of the Thaw brothers and your sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the Thaw brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the Thaw brothers and our sisters. The people organized can build the kind of future we want.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I am Mickey Huff, and I'm joined today with guest co-host Michael Sukoff. Our listeners probably remember Michael from doing shows with Peter Phillips. And so, Michael, welcome back to the co-host.
Thank you, Mickey.
Great to have you here. On our segment today, our first segment, we're going to be looking at, well, something that we're no strangers to here at Project Censored, that fake news. And we're joined by the acclaimed independent and investigative journalist, award-winning, Project Censored award-winning journalist, Dave Lindorf of thiscan'tbehappening.net. And again, if our listeners aren't familiar with Dave Lindorf, you really should be. And he actually has yet another story in Censored 2018. But today, we're going to be talking with Dave Lindorf about a new piece that he has published recently at Salon.com. And it is called The Attack on Fake News is Really an Attack on Alternative Media. Dave Lindorf, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you back, Dave, and you're always doing so much. As we speak, you have a very recent piece on presidents' authority to launch nuclear weapons. And again, you're pretty prolific in terms of your journalism. And at the Project, we've known about your work for years. And very recently here, you did a fantastic piece for Salon.com that really unpacks a lot of what's been happening around the infatuation with fake news and the way that it's been twisted and the way that it's been weaponized. And you actually interviewed me and Jim Narekis from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. But let's dive into this topic and the attack on fake news. How did you get into this, Dave Lindorf?
I was labeled absurdly pro-Russian propagandist in that, indirectly at least, in that Washington Post front page outrage by Craig Timberg, you know, the proper not thing.
Yes.
Where they ran this article by their supposed security expert, saying that there were these 200 websites that were just propaganda vehicles for Russia. And one of them was Counterpunch. And when I clicked on Counterpunch on the list that they were referring to by this organization, which the Post allowed to be unidentified beyond its name in terms of who's funding it or the leadership of it, or even who the investigators were who came up with this list, I clicked on Counterpunch, and it gave two reasons why they were claiming it was a Russian propaganda vehicle, and one of them was an article by me, a piece I actually did for This Can't Be Happening, so I was sort of sorry that This Can't Be Happening didn't itself get put on the list.
But nor was Project Censored. We need to work harder, Dave.
Well, I mean, it shows how bad they are, because the list should have gone to the original source. Counterpunch runs most of our stuff, but you ought to get credit to the original place. This is kind of WikiLeaks research they were doing. And the article was actually not in any way pro-Russian. It simply was a piece, and I don't claim any great expertise on it. It's just that it was referring to the investigation by the Dutch-Australian prosecutors into the shootdown of the Malaysian jumbo jet over Ukraine in 2014. And when they released last September their report saying that the Russians did it, surprise, surprise, I merely said, based on all the reading I'd done on it, that it was not a legitimate investigation because, one, they had rejected all offers from Russia to provide evidence in the case, case. And two, they were operating under an agreement where Ukraine had veto power over any conclusions they came up with. And three, a lot of their evidence was coming from Ukrainian intelligence. So it was a fake investigation with a predetermined outcome, and that was all I said. So for that, it was labeled absurdly pro-Russian propaganda, and, you know, accordingly, Counterpunch was put on the list. But this was just an example to me that cried out for an article, that this fake news thing has shifted from Donald Trump calling everything that he doesn't like fake news,
right,
to the media itself being under attack from the Trumps and the conservatives, the media now accusing alternative media of being fake news, and the government also. And it plays into this of Russia doing all these nefarious things like trying to influence the election.
And the United States has never tried to influence other elections, and we've certainly never been involved in overthrowing elected governments.
Never does that get mentioned, that the U.S. has a
memory hole context,
long history of this or longer. And what Russia was doing is pretty above board. I mean, buying ads on Twitter is not illegal.
Facebook, right.
And Facebook is not illegal. And RTTV is a Russian-financed television operation in America. But I would argue, and full disclosure, I get interviewed on it a lot. I would say it's a better source of news on most things than the U.S. media, which is so propagandistic and so pro-government, particularly on international news.
Well, RT certainly has their issues, but they also have stellar programs and shows. I mean, any outlet has issues.
By the way, I'm being interviewed and you're being interviewed by an agent of a foreign government.
When's the BBC going to register?
Yeah, exactly. Or HMS.
Yeah, how about NPR? Maybe they can register over in Moscow. But all kidding and satire aside here, it's hard to keep it down. Some of this stuff is fairly ridiculous. Prop or Not also used the phrases useful idiots. And that's the kind of stuff we're hearing about people being on RT. But I want to shift a little bit away from RT. This is a huge focus of our book right this year. Censor 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. I have a chapter with numerous students and Nolan Higdon on this issue that really focuses on the issues of fake news, post-truth dystopia, fake news, alternative facts, and the ongoing war on reality. And we highlight Craig Timberg. We highlighted the Prop or Not piece. We mentioned Counterpunch, Truth Out, Naked Capitalism. We mentioned the absurdity of the article. And Marty Baron, who is the executive editor at the Washington Post, which let's not forget, owned by Jeff Bezos, right?
Amazon, right.
Who got a $600 million contract from the CIA months after taking over the Washington Post. Just put that out there. They issued a partial retraction, but they never really retracted anything. Marty Baron promoted on social media this Prop or Not article and then pretended like, well, we didn't really do anything and we didn't really promote it. I mean, he's just blatantly lying.
He was tweeting all over the place about it when it came out. And, you know, one of the worst things about it was I read it first in the Philadelphia Inquirer, which ran it verbatim on page one, and they didn't bother to check it out at all. I called them and suggested I write a piece about how bad it was and how one-sided journalism it was. They expressed concern about it, but they didn't run my op-ed piece.
Well, you know, Dave Lindorf, they checked out the Washington Post article about as much as Craig Timberg checked out Prop or Not.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is not journalism. It's stenography. It's propaganda. Dare I say that's almost a form of fake news.
No, it is. That was my point, is that, you know, the real fake news is happening in the mainstream media. There's certainly fake news on the left and right in the alternative media, too. But you can't just say fake news is a problem on the left or on the right or anywhere. But I would suggest there's more of it, and I'll say that in honor of my friend Ed Herman. You know, he spent a career pointing out the fakeness of the news in the mainstream media. This isn't anything new. But the thing that I also wanted to talk about is this term alternative fact.
Okay, well, Dave Lindorf, we're going to do that. I need to take a really quick ID, and after we come back, I want to talk about alternative facts, and Michael Sukoff is going to jump into the conversation with us. I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, and you just heard Dave Lindorf, the investigative reporter from ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, and I also want to piggyback off of what Dave Lindorf just said briefly. briefly before we go to a musical break, with great respect and remembrance to the amazing, prolific, and brilliant Edward Herman, who passed away recently. Best known, arguably, for the Manufacturing Consent with Noam Chomsky in 1988 that gave us the propaganda model. I'd also like to throw out there that in addition to the recent monthly review piece that he did earlier in the summer on fake news in Russia, I'd like to remind listeners that Ed Herman, we're honored to say this, Ed Herman, I believe his last published piece is in Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World. Edward Herman gave us a chapter called Still Manufacturing Consent, the Propaganda Model at 30. And I certainly urge listeners to check out that chapter. So after this brief musical break, we'll come back and we'll talk more about fake news and alternative facts with Dave Lindorf. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, and I'm joined in studio with Michael Sukoff. And we're talking today with investigative journalist Dave Lindorf, many-time Project Censored Award winner and numerous other journalistic awards. ThisCan'tBeHappening.net is where you can find Dave Lindorf's work. Of course, he's also published on Counterpunch and many other places. But Dave Lindorf, we wanted to go and we wanted to move into a connected realm to fake news, which is alternative facts. But I'd like to have Michael Sukoff jump in here. I think he wanted to have a couple words with you.
Thank you, Mickey. Dave Lindorf, I've noticed over the last few months, and this is apropos of your comment about how the phenomenon of fake news has spread across the whole spectrum of the media, including, to a certain extent, alternative media. And what I've noticed is that on some alternative media venues, this concept or this term fake news has in a way been almost uncritically adopted in order to talk about the phenomenon, but in a way that to me accepts the terms of that phrase uncritically. Would you have any comment on that?
Yeah, I think you're making a good point. There's wrong news and there's fake news. You can, and if this is what you're talking about, you know, as a journalist, you can get things wrong. You can be misinformed by a source that you are unable to catch. You can have a wrong premise when you go into a story and, you know, you may follow up with another story and correct it and things like that. But fake news is where you actually are seeking to deceive the reader. And a good example of that was the WMD story that got us into the Iraq War. There was a real effort by Cheney and his group to conjure up evidence that would make a case for attacking Iraq. That's really, I think, a classic case of fake news. And there's a lot of it around. The fake news about voter fraud, for example, is another good example of fake news. People that are perpetrating that story know that it's fake. They know that the incidence of voter fraud is so minuscule as to be irrelevant.
Dave Lindorf, it's also the case here that oftentimes fake news is accompanied by what appear to be alternative facts.
Yes, and that's why I wanted to jump into the fact part, because the thing that's wrong with the description alternative facts is that alternative facts is not a negative. Alternative facts is what I actually spend most of my career working with. And the alternative facts are the facts that challenge the official consensus, but they're real. Just as an example, a story I know you're familiar with that I had handed to me on a platter by the Partnership for Civil Justice was an FBI memo in this dump they got of data from Homeland Security and the FBI when they were looking into the government's role in the Occupy crackdown. And it was an FBI memo from the Houston FBI office referring to a known plot to identify the leadership of the Houston Occupy movement and to assassinate them with silencer sniper rifles.
And we covered that story.
Yeah. Well, I broke that story with that memo, and I researched it. I called the FBI office and said, how come this terrorist plot was never busted? You never arrested anybody, even though you said in the memo that you identified the people involved and you knew about it, and it didn't happen, and they were saying that they were going to do it if deemed necessary. It talked about conducting intelligence to discover who the leadership was and then assassinating them, and you didn't arrest anybody. How can this be when you're always touting all these terrorist plots you bust? And they had no comment on that, and they said, you should call the Houston police. And I said, I called them and I said, were you guys ever notified? You're responsible for public safety. Did the FBI office in Houston ever alert you that there was this plot? And they said, we've never heard of it. Now, I don't know if that's true, but it might have been the Houston police, for God's sakes, you know. That story went exactly nowhere after I ran it, and it got picked up a lot in the alternative media, but the mainstream media simply did nothing with it. So there's an example of an alternative fact, and it was a fact with an FBI memo attached to it, supported by another letter referring to it by the Jacksonville, Florida FBI office that didn't get reported in the mainstream media because it didn't comport with the consensus view that the FBI is good guys.
Well, indeed, Dave Lindorf, this term alternative facts, again, in its current iteration, is birthed by none other than the counselor Kellyanne Conway, going back to the inauguration of Trump in January.
Referring to her being caught in a lie.
So there we go. So what we're getting at now is we're generating in this post-truth world, right? Oxford Dictionary last year used that phrase that it was the word of the year. And what does post-truth give us but fake news, which is buttressed by a different kind of alternative facts? And that's basically manufacturing evidence in a confirmation bias way to support an alternative reality. And that's pretty much what we see almost daily from the Trump administration and the corporate press.
Right. I just simply want to hang on to protecting the authenticity of alternative facts. You know, the fake news thing, okay, I mean, we all sort of know what real fake news is, and I think it's a valid term as applied to things that are appearing in all kinds of journals, but especially when it occurs in the mainstream media, corporate media. But alternative facts, I think we need to hang on to because they are important. They're critical to get out the alternative facts that clarify what the truth is.
Dave Lindorf, can I follow up on that a little bit as a devil's advocate? My concern would be, well, let me make sure I understand. You're saying that you want to preserve the authenticity of the term alternative facts. Is that what you said?
So right.
I'm not quite clear what one would be trying to preserve there, because I see that that whole phrase is very problematic. First of all, in the classical interpretation of fact, it's simply something that's true. So if we introduce the adjective alternative, then what are we saying about the truth? I mean, that's the first place I would start to kind of wonder about that term. So what does it mean to have another fact competing with?
The point would be that truth is not a fact. Truth is truth, right? Truth is buttressed by fact. And so if you don't accept the term alternative fact as being a neutral term, simply different from another fact, then you have to have true facts and false facts. The point of an alternative fact to me is that, you know, when you swear an oath in court and you testify and you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so there are truths that are not the whole truth. And you can come up with an untrue story by presenting some true facts, but you don't present others. And so the alternative facts are the ones that you're not presenting.
Yeah, that's the historic definition that you're giving that goes back. It's different, right? So you're talking about facts that are left out of the dominant narrative.
Yeah, exactly. So those are the alternative facts to those.
Unlike Kellyanne Conway's utterly manufactured alternative non-facts.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, her facts weren't facts.
No, they were not. In fact, they were not.
They were alternative lies.
Indeed. Dave Lindorf, we only have a few minutes left in the segment, and I wanted to remind listeners of this piece. The attack on fake news is really an attack on alternative media. And so in a couple of minutes, can you sort of unpack that thesis about how this is? We already started the conversation with this, but in your article, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and you talked to me about a little bit about this. And again, I want to underscore that a lot of what's been happening here is an attack on independent media, alternative media, and anything, any narrative that challenges the dominant narrative.
Yeah, quite consciously. And let me say really quickly that if someone wants to find that story, because they get lost and so on after they've run, you can go to my site, thiscan'tbehappening.net, scroll down on the homepage. It's still there. And then there's a link to it from a couple of opening paragraphs.
It's also on the Project Censored Facebook page.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, the point that I was making in the story then is that the mainstream media has grasped onto this fake news thing, and the government, too. The government has passed this bill allocating $160-some million over 2 years to the State Department to look for fake news being disseminated about the U.S. government and its policies.
Also in our book.
Yeah, and then to present a government-sanctioned alternative story to tell the, quote, truth. So we're really getting into Orwellian world here. And so there's part of that campaign that's a big threat now. That's why they've now labeled RTTV, forced them to register as a foreign agent. And it's a direction we're heading where pretty soon we're going to see this metastasize into the alternative media. And there, the danger is that we have these big corporate internet companies that have the power to slow down or make unsearchable alternative media and alternative stories and these true alternative facts that people need to get.
And that's already happening through algorithms
and so forth. It is happening.
Well, Dave Lindorf, we're going to have you back on the program because we want to pick up the conversation. This is an ongoing thing, and it's going to be an ongoing challenge for all of us in terms of those of us that really champion media freedom and a truly free press. And Dave Lindorf, you're certainly an exemplary investigative reporter, and you'll be definitely a person that we're going to be turning back to in the near future. So thanks
Anytime.
So much.
Thanks for having me on.
It's always a pleasure, Dave Lindorf. So thiscan'tbehappening.net is where you can learn more. I'm Mickey Huff with Michael Zukoff, and you're listening to the Project Censored Show. So after this brief musical break, we'll continue. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're going to be interviewing someone that you all know, you Project Censored listeners. We're going to be joined by one of our co-hosts of the Project Censored Show, Professor Nolan Higdon. He is a professor of communications and history at Diablo Valley College, Cal State, East Bay, and other places around the San Francisco Bay Area. Nolan Higdon is a board member of the Media Freedom Foundation. He's been working with Project Censored for a number of years and has contributed numerous chapters to our books. He is also one of the co-founders of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. And in this year's Censored book, 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, Nolan Higdon also co-authored a chapter with another one of our affiliates. That would be Professor Nicholas Baham III, and you may hear his voice as one of our co-hosts as well. They did a chapter on the new American authoritarianism, how corporate media normalized racism in 2016. Nolan Higdon, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Mickey, thanks for having me. This is cool to do a show together. This is nice.
Yes, it is definitely a good thing. We're looking forward to the conversation. And, of course, we brought you on the program because one of the things that we all talk about at Project Censored is the antidote to fake news, or so-called fake news, as being critical media literacy education. And in the previous segment of the program, we were joined by investigative journalist Dave Lindorf, and we talked with him about a recent piece that he did at Salon. And of course, Dave Lindorf was one of the people named as an alleged pro-Russian propagandist. He did a piece called "The Attack on Fake News is Really an Attack on Alternative Media." And Dave Lindorf and I were just talking about the many different iterations of fake news, alternative facts. The first segment, we were joined by one of our other co-hosts, Michael Sukoff, sociologist. But Nolan, let's just start diving in here about this whole business of fake news. It's sort of the meme that doesn't go away.
Yeah, it's become such a powerful term. Of course, fake news originally, sort of the term was used in the late 19th century, talking about anything that was unsubstantiated or false but presented as a news story. Trump weaponized the term as anything that he finds to be an inconvenient truth, much like liberal media was used previously by conservatives to denounce anything that was an inconvenient truth. But there's also been another interesting use as well, which is there's been this conversation about so-called Russiagate, that the Russians drop this barrage of fake news into the U.S. media. And so far, even the evidence that's been provided by people who believe this theory have been a series of memes. And if you actually look at the memes, it's quite interesting. They're not fake in the sense that they're false. They actually just sort of tell stories or give views that feed into partisan and divisive culture. So you have, like, memes about Bernie Sanders pointing out that there's problems with the Clinton Foundation. He actually said those things. That's not false. So the meme then serves to create this divisiveness amongst Democrats or leftists choosing between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. But I would, point out that the problem there actually starts with the Clinton Foundation itself, not the fact that Bernie makes the comment. And similarly, you have memes that sort of worship people who are at the border of the U.S.-Mexico border chasing down immigrants, and it glorifies them and feeds into this divisive culture, hyper-race-filled divisive culture over immigration and border patrol. But again, that's not something the Russians created. Racism and this faith in the border patrol, that's something that the U.S. created. So we're kind of blaming Russia for problems in the U.S. All Russia's really doing is exploiting those problems, if at all.
Well, that's, again, we keep hearing about Russia being involved in colluding to tip the election, and the way we're using the term fake news here, what you just described is more partisan news or so-called ads and so forth. But this isn't false information, and it's important to underscore this. This is, in fact, what Dave Lindorf was also saying, is that it isn't as though that this information is false. It just challenges the dominant and official narratives. And, of course, the establishment political parties don't want to be challenged. And, by the way, of course, neither does the corporate press. The corporate media doesn't really like being challenged in that regard either, which is why we find ourselves in a pretty strange conundrum. We've had many people now have the fake news label on the radar. And in fact, over 60% of people in recent polls claimed in the United States that fake news was actually a serious or, quote, very serious problem. Without necessarily going into details about defining it or differentiating it from these ads or from these confirmation bias kinds of articles, I think certainly one of the things that we want to maybe ferret out here is that we have a problem with corporate media, that they're not reporting the things that these so-called fake news reports were doing that were actually not fake, they were real. But then we also have the problem of Trump weaponizing the term fake news to attack all media, while corporate media uses the term to attack alternative media. So let's unpack that triangulated problem a little bit.
Yeah, no, I think it's well said. It's like a circular firing squad at some level here with these different groups that are involved. But yeah, people agree that fake news is a problem. But as you point out, getting them to agree on what fake news actually is a much larger problem. Currently, we have a really kind of interesting dilemma in U.S. history. It's called the so-called post-truth world, and actually post-truth was added to the dictionary recently. But Americans are now able to customize whatever information they read, whatever friends they have, whatever news they view. Companies like Google and Facebook customize searches for the things you're most likely to click on, not necessarily the things you most likely need to read. And so we have these fragmented silos of reality that individuals are living within. And anything that challenges those silos is attacked as quote-unquote fake news. And some of these people are in partisan silos, like Democratic Party silos, where they read MSNBC and Huffington Post exclusively. Some people are in conservative ones with Fox News and InfoWars and Breitbart. Others are in white supremacist silos, et cetera, you name it. But we've constructed these silos, and it's made discussion really difficult. And when people are confronted with facts that challenge them, they take the intellectual shortcut of deeming it fake news, rather than engaging how they might have to change their view and conception of the world given these new facts in front of them. And we're not going to be able to address that larger post-truth problem if we can't agree on what fake news is. We sort of have to cut this all the way down to facts do exist. We can argue about what the facts mean, but we need to start somewhere where facts actually exist. When you have people labeling any inconvenient fact as fake news, it makes it impossible to have those discussions and debates, and so we end up just kind of spinning our wheels. Carl Bernstein said, and I thought this was a great term recently, he said we're in a cold civil war, where basically we have these multiple sides fighting each other with these different realities. And so it makes debate almost impossible.
Well, one wonders if that's not the ultimate purpose, is to, in this terms of divisiveness, and I know that's one of the arguments that has come up with when people are talking about alleged Russian collusion or Russian interference, is to sow confusion, sow dissent, sow hostility, and so forth in these confirmation bias silos. And this is, of course, the Oxford Dictionary that declared post-truth the hyphenated word of the year last year. That's defined as, quote, relating to or denoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. And so we all have our confirmation bias, motivated reasoning problems, inferred justification problems. In fact, you and I, of course, teach about this, you know, and this is what we teach is critical media literacy education as the antidote to this, in order to unpack this, not only be cognizant of our own confirmation biases, but also be able to do things like fact check and check for information veracity. And we can have all the solutions we want. We can have algorithms that created the problem as alleged solutions that are now suppressing alternative media voices, which is what Dave Lindorf is talking about. We had a blacklist. Right, and he was the victim of blacklisting with Propernot and others. Even academics have taken to blacklisting, which is disheartening to see in terms of academic freedom. We've also seen legislative proposals that have failed miserably. One trying to ban fake news in California without defining it. Thankfully, that was laughed off the internet within a week. But ultimately, one of the things that seems to be left out is education. And you have your doctorate in education, and you focused specifically in your dissertation on education as one of the solutions to this, and particularly for people very interested in social justice issues and helping understand marginalized populations and so forth, and what role media can play in transforming our society. So, riffing on what you were just saying with that Bernstein information about this siloed information, what do you think we could be doing in terms of our educational system to address the so-called scourge of fake news?
I think education is the only sort of lifeline we have, the only possibility we have. Because let's just concede for a moment, let's say the Russians are behind all of these divisive memes and they're the ones who are spreading this divisiveness. Even if you make the Russians go away, that divisiveness has always been there and always existed. And so you need some mechanism to undermine racism, falsehoods, sexism, you name it, propaganda. And so education can be that pathway. And my study found out that critical media literacy can be effective in getting students to become more civically engaged. That means not just voting, but also participating in the system as a whole. It can increase their social justice attitudes, which means they're more aware of inequality and oppression and more willing to engage in resistance. We also found that critical media literacy made students more engaged and empowered in the classroom, which was critical. And most importantly, they became more critical of the media they consumed. They didn't become willing participants. They sort of asked questions like, who's constructing this news? Who pays for this news? Who's treated as newsworthy in this story? Are there solutions here? Why are there not solutions here? And so effective education like that is key. And we've had, you know, about 30 or 40 years ago, most nations in Europe, Asia, and Northern Africa, they started offering media literacy and courses to their students, mandated in schools. The U.S. did not. We were going through our neoliberal, market-driven purpose behind everything, history beginning there. And we did not offer critical media literacy, but there's kind of something critical for your listeners to understand, that there's a difference in critical media literacy and media literacy. So there's a lot of libraries right now and schools who are engaging in media literacy, and you really want to follow the money there. A lot of money for media literacy comes from Sony and Nickelodeon and AT&T and others, and Microsoft, Apple. And they give this money in exchange. The curriculum is really trying to teach students how to become dependent upon digital tools. It protects against some things like obesity, and exposure to certain content. But for the most part, it's teaching them how to become dependent upon these tools and use them for market-driven purposes. Critical media literacy, on the other hand, talks about power. How can we use these tools to empower ourselves? How can we overcome power inequities? How can we ameliorate inequities in society using these tools? And also, how can we look at how these tools contribute to problems as well as alleviate them? So, for example, one of the critiques against the digital age is that these screens make people feel empowered to do things they wouldn't do in person, right? Whether make, say, racist comments or maybe shame people online. They do this because they're behind a screen. They feel comfortable. There's also a positive way, though, that power works. I mean, you're seeing this now with the hashtag MeToo campaign right now, that social networking and social media is empowering individuals to speak up who have been attacked and marginalized and victims of abuse. And so these things cut both ways, but only if we really examine and understand these tools can we figure out how to use them ethically. As well as to better society.
Well, you know, Rachel Jolly of the Index on Censorship was on the Project Censored show not long ago talking about the power of radio and podcasting to do exactly what you were just explaining in the latter part of your example as part of the solution to not just giving voice, but providing platform for marginalized voices and people dissenting oppressive power structures. And, of course, one of the great critical media literacy theoretical tools we have was put forward by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky 30 years ago, the propaganda model in the book Manufacturing Consent on Political Economy of Mass Media. And of course, Edward Herman recently passed away. And in fact, we're honored to have among the last things he's written in our 2018 book, Still Manufacturing Consent, The Propaganda Model at 30. And that model really still holds up. It's an excellent example of the difference between critical media literacy education, understanding ownership and advertising and capitalist markets and how that shapes messaging, versus the kind of self-promotional, corporate-backed kind of media literacy that you were just describing earlier.
Oh, agreed. These things, you know, on one hand I say unfortunately remain relevant, but on the other hand, fortunately we have these tools to look back at how to examine media. And, you know, teaching students things like the propaganda model or, of course, what Project Censored does with validated independent news and junk food news and news abuse, when students do these things in the classroom, they start to normalize behavior in how they consume media in a very positive way. And as you pointed out earlier, it's not about giving them lists of what you should and shouldn't read. And you know as well as I do, we always get asked by students, well, where should I get my news? And the answer is kind of like everywhere. But these exercises in the classroom enable students to start these habits to be more responsible media consumers. And you can use something like the propaganda model as a guide to explain to students why we need to develop these habits. We live in the most media-saturated society on Earth. It's sort of absurd to believe that we would send people into the world, young people in particular, without the skills to navigate through this media-saturated society. But we have, you know, a large portion of our society who isn't even taught how to use digital tools, even though our economy and political and social systems are more dependent upon them. And then we have another part of our society as well that not only doesn't have access to these tools, but also has never been taught how to use them. And we call that the digital divide. So I look back at sort of the United States election of 2016, and there was a lot of lambasting of journalists, and rightfully so, about our failed news media institutions. But I would also say we'll use a lot of that anger toward our education system as well. You know, these reforms we did, we raised a generation of bubble fillers, people who know how to choose the best answer, but are not really equipped with the critical thinking skills to ask what answers don't exist, why are these the only options I'm offered, and what other tools are, you know, accessible to me to change the options that are on this test.
We're speaking with Dr. Nolan Higdon. He's an affiliate with us at Project Censored. He's a professor of communications and history. He's contributed many chapters to the Project Censored books over the years. He's also one of our associate co-hosts, so you've certainly heard him on the show before. This time around, we've flipped the microphones, and I'm interviewing Nolan Higdon about his expertise on critical media literacy education, particularly as we are framing this conversation under fake news and the problems of it, and how the antidotes involved would be education. But Nolan, you were just going into education, and I want to dive into education and neoliberal education policies as part of the contributing problem here. But first, we want to take a quick break. So I just want to remind listeners, this is Mickey Huff. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. And after this brief musical break, we'll return with Dr. Nolan Higdon. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're speaking with Professor Nolan Higdon. He's, of course, a longtime affiliate with Project Censored, longtime contributor, co-host on our show. And today we flipped the mic where I'm actually talking to him about his area of expertise, which is critical media literacy education. And Nolan Higdon was a principal co-founder of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project, and Project Censored works with that, Media Freedom Foundation, one of the co-sponsors, and also work with the Action Coalition for Media Education. That would be ACME, smartmediaeducation.net, and gcml.org. So if you're interested in learning more about the things that critical media literacy educators do, you can check out those sites. And of course, you can go to projectcensored.org and check out any of our annual books from Seven Stories Press. Nolan Higdon, let's get back to this conversation, because where you ended it was exactly where I wanted to go next. You mentioned that we now are faced with a new generation of bubble fillers, the No Child Left Behind generation. Can you talk to us a little bit about neoliberal education policy and how that's also set us up for the current conundrum?
Yeah, absolutely. This is germinated out of the 1970s. There was the Department of Education is created. It decides it's going to overhaul education, and there's this push for reforms. At the same time, you had a lot of right-wing groups, big foundations coming out, and they were paying for these studies called like Nation at Risk and others that said that our education system was largely failing the population. It's worth to know that there was objective studies that came out at the same time that drew the exact opposite of conclusions of nations at risk. But a lot of these conservative politicians, the Reagan administration in particular, picked these up, and they used this to start gutting away at sort of faith in educators and faith in teachers, and was used as political propaganda to break teacher unions, which they were successful doing with No Child Left Behind, but to only blame Republicans would be very misleading. No Child Left Behind actually came from Senator Ted Kennedy, who was pushing for a civil rights education bill. And so No Child Left Behind came out of this idea that the education systems were not serving students of color and that they needed to better serve students of color. That was actually true, but the problem was about wealth inequality. As taxpayers had cut taxes, wealthy white neighborhoods were getting more money into their schools and non-white neighborhoods were not. But rather than address that issue, No Child Left Behind said we were going to test all students with standardized tests, and the tests that came out well, those schools would get money. The tests that did poorly, they would lose money, and if they couldn't afford to be open, those poor schools would be taken over by private companies. So in essence, the tests were actually testing the teachers, and any student who's ever done a standardized test will tell you that they didn't wake up thinking they were going to do their honest and best for their teacher.
Well, indeed. In other words, there's not just one standard, so that's part of the first problem. And secondarily, this is a Trojan horse for potential privatization and attack on teachers and academic freedom.
Right. And so they're successful in that. It's slightly altered with Common Core, but the focus of the education system then becomes what we call schooling, not education, as Neil Postman talks about, which is basically the fill and drill model. You fill them with information, and then they blurt it out on tests. Well, this comes at the expense of things like critical thinking or civic engagement. Only 20% of our high schools require civics in high school graduation anymore. And so we have a generation that largely doesn't know about this sort of world they're engaging in. There's no media literacy or critical media literacy for these students. And this education model, they're now applying to community colleges and state colleges as well. Kind of the next iterative of this is going to be for these colleges. They're going to have to alter themselves to test outcomes and data. And you can see the numbers. Teacher unions are paying less, and part-time teachers who actually work double and three times as much as full-time teachers are starting to make up the majority, sometimes three-fourths of campuses. So this has really gutted away at this institution, and so educators and people who support education, and especially students, really need to fight back against this wave, because these schools are not serving them by giving them high test scores.
So we have a generation of people that aren't really being taught about civic engagement or service learning. They're not really being taught about critical media literacy and how to navigate these kinds of partisan landscapes. And social media, you know, Adam Bessie, English professor at Diablo Valley College, we wrote years ago in an older censored book about junk food news and news abuse on a feed-to-know basis, and which basically kind of predicted how social media would be based on this confirmation bias algorithm that would make it so that we don't see or hear alternate views or views that counter the ones that we come to think about or believe, and it would contribute to the atrophying of critical thinking. And of course, you know, Henry Giroux has written a lot about this, numerous other scholars as well. But it's also important to mention Diane Ravitch, I think, because she was originally one of the supporters of No Child Left Behind and then came out notoriously opposing it, and has been one of the most powerful, rational, and intellectual voices against this kind of standardized top-down education that we've seen, and she was vilified and attacked greatly for it.
Yeah, and so you end up with a generation who really can't participate equally in the society in which they're entering, and because of the highest wealth inequality in U.S. history and college tuition and student loan debt, which is $1.6 trillion, they really become market-focused and market-driven and not participating in civics and other things. Or when they do participate, it's to their own detriment a lot of times, right? And that's a problem that some education institutions need to fix, is providing better civics and better information on how the system works. But that's going to be a big, big change that you would need to get a lot of people, a lot of politicians on board with. But I think it's an area of focus, given the U.S. presidential election in 2016, that we need to dramatically change our media system, but also our education systems as well, because you have individuals, as I mentioned earlier, they take intellectual shortcuts. So an intellectual shortcut to this barrage of all different news media and trying to figure out what's true or false, an intellectual shortcut is, I'm just not going to listen to the news, or I'm just going to listen to this news and not that news. You really need to be more complex thinker and recognize facts and implicit bias and things like that. You can't take these kinds of shortcuts.
Well, unfortunately, we see more of the shortcuts coming in California. We're seeing what looks like the K-12ization, corporatization of the community college system, which is the largest higher educational system in the world, 113 campuses, nearly 3 million students. We're seeing this wheeling out without much consultation of faculty of something called guided pathways, which takes a slap at a so-called cafeteria approach that's saying that the snowflake students of the No Child Left Behind generation can't make decisions and can't handle the rigors of college, so we need to make pathways that make it simpler for them that ultimately are really about matriculation rates and putting people through the system in terms of bean counting for money rather than actually making sure people are learning how to be critical thinkers, independent thinkers, and be agents of their own interests, and particularly that of people of various demographics and marginalized communities. What can you say about that, Dr. Nolan Higdon?
Well, one, it just shows them a massive amount of hubris that they would think that they know what's best for students to take. You know, depending on individual's history, experience, and interests, a student can determine those types of things. A second thing I would say, too, is there are multiple reasons why individuals are in college. Not all individuals are there to get a bachelor's degree. Not all individuals are there to get a master's degree. Some are interested in just learning. Some are just looking for a certificate. Some are just there to spend time and sort of take classes randomly. So to make a quote-unquote guided pathway, you lock out a lot of the students, the so-called students you're trying to include, by only focusing on transfers or degree rates or bachelor's degrees. Kind of one of the beautiful things about colleges in the United States in general, but California in particular, is we have a lot of diverse offerings and diverse student bodies who are able to choose classes and engage with each other in different environments. Guided pathways really would come, I think, at the expense of that. And also the way that to implement something that's going to be this costly, they're going to have to collect, quote-unquote, data to determine whether or not it's effective, and that's going to change the way the education in the classroom operates, much like No Child Left Behind did with K-12. So I would, you know, really encourage both students and faculty to pay attention to what goes on their campus, because if you rewind back 25, 30 years ago, K-12 teachers would never have imagined something like No Child Left Behind could come into their institutions. And I feel like many in the higher education need to face that right now.
Well, it definitely is coming. But like I said, now that it's already being introduced and there are prototype programs and so on, it does seem to be a Trojan horse for restricting academic freedom, for hiring more administrators or people that are going to oversee the implementation of these kinds of programs rather than actual full-time faculty. And as we know clearly, certainly in the community college system in the state of California, we're widely out of compliance in terms of full-time versus contingent adjunct faculty. That's another major issue that this seems to be skirting or obfuscating.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. The data argument about student success is a total distraction, and it's used as justification for the quote-unquote reforms that come at the expense of academic freedom, and so you can exploit teachers more. Because if you really want data on students, we have had data for generations, centuries. They're called grades. We've had those. So this data movement has really been used as a way to empower administrators, create more positions, and ultimately break teacher unions so they can do with education what they think is there to do, which is market-driven. And so they want to make it market-driven, get rid of the social sciences, the civics, these other perspectives, and make it all about jobs, jobs, jobs.
Well, I wonder where and what the jobs, jobs, jobs are as we enter an AI world and an era of near automation. Maybe Nolan Higdon, it doesn't behoove the establishment to have a generation of critical thinkers.
I completely agree on that. This is the invisible product that a lot of these educational institutions are selling right now. You have these millennials racking up massive amounts of tuition and student loan debt, $1.6 trillion, and you're promising them they're going to get a job that's not only going to pay for their lifestyle but also pay off that debt. You're really selling an invisible product. That's a pretty big promise to make to a young person, and I would encourage administrators as well as educators to think about that before they promise it to their students.
Well, let's wrap up the interview talking, you know, where you and I started here. It sounds like that promise might be fake news.
Yeah, it might be.
I mean, I guess not to be too coy or cynical about it, but we realize education and a free press are important components that should be promoting civic engagement for people to understand what's going on, and not only understand what's going on in their political climate and in their society and their communities and their neighborhoods, but also these should be systems that encourage participation. So let's end on that note. Let's end on a positive note, because, of course, at Project Censored and the work that you do and that we all do, it really encourages participation, and it encourages young people, people of all ages, actually, of course, because at the community college particularly, we get a wide demographic of people coming in as lifelong learners, which used to be a serious mission of the community college. But this kind of participation, in your experience, in your research, in your dissertation, you've actually seen and have proven that this really does change people's lives for the better.
Yeah, we think, you know, we basically found that people who you teach them at a young age to be more responsible media producers, they become more responsible media consumers. And so by equipping students with these skills, they're able to protect themselves, but also be able to create be agents of change, use media to make positive changes in the society. And this includes, you know, being civically engaged, or as you mentioned before, creating platforms. And so you can see a transformation of students. And I would highly, you know, encourage people to look at some of the stuff at the Global Critical Media Literacy Project or projectcenter.org. Because if you do give students critical media literacy education, they're likely to use it. And millennials in particular, they've shown themselves very interested in participation. They've shown themselves willing to engage in confrontation with the establishment. But we'd really need to, as educators and as citizens of society, provide them with the tools to succeed. And so they can be agents of change. And that means being an ally of theirs and letting them lead the way, but supporting them strongly.
Well, Dr. Nolan Higdon, I wanted to thank you for joining us on the Project Censored show, again on the other side of the mic today, sharing your expertise and your experience in education, particularly about critical media literacy education, and of course also about fighting fake news. And of course, we have our main area of agreement here is that education is really one of the best tools we have, critical thinking skills, one of the best tools we have, and we're going to continue to keep promoting that. So thank you, Nolan Higdon, for all the work that you're doing. Listeners who want to find out more about Nolan, you can go to projectcensored.org and you can see his latest published work in Censored 2018, Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, edited by myself and Andy Lee Roth. Nolan Higdon, thanks so much for joining the show today.
Thanks for having me, Mickey.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in today. I'm Mickey Huff. You're listening to the Project Censored show. Our program airs on 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Founders and executive producers of the Project Censored show, myself, along with Dr. Peter Phillips. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest, an assistant producer is Mitch Scorza. We'd also like to welcome a new associate producer with us. That would be Dennis Murphy, coming to us from the Petaluma Community Access, Community Media. It's KPCA out of Petaluma, California, also one of our newest affiliates. I'd like to thank Erica Bridgman, our engineer, as well. If you want to learn more about Project Censored, go to projectcensored.org. You can also find us on our Patreon account to support this work. We'll be back with you next week for another action-packed program. Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.